Welcome back. I'm Carl Etnayer. This is Equal Time on WDEV AM and FM. For the rest of the show, we'll be talking about the book Your Money or Your Life, a financial guide that asks basic questions like, what do you really need money for? It was first published during the boom times of the 1990s, and it's even more pertinent now with the bust years of the 21st century. Our guests today on Your Money or Your Life are Monique Tilford. She's a co-author of the revised edition, and Jane Dwinell, who lives in Montpelier and lives the program. And as am I, Jane is part of the blogging team at Vermont Commons website, vtcommons.org. She writes a blog on frugal living with her daughter, Dana Dwinell Yardley. Jane, you're here in the studio. Welcome to Equal Time.
Thanks.
And Monique, you're on the phone. Hello, Monique.
Hello, yes, I'm here.
Welcome. Monique, Your Money or Your Life, it sounds like something a comic strip mugger would say. What does it mean as a title of your book?
Well, it's just a statement to help people be aware. It is, like you said, a comic book sort of title, but we want people to raise awareness about are you really choosing your money or your life? Most Americans are choosing their money much more than they realize.
What does that mean, to choose your money rather than your life?
Well, it means that people are not aware that they have a limited time on the planet, and a lot of people are chasing money much more than they're aware that their quality of life is actually suffering quite a bit from this ever-pursuit of money.
Hmm. And, once they get the money, aren't they able to use it to buy things or buy houses in neighborhoods they like that increase the quality of their life?
Yes, certainly we all need enough money to be able to meet our survival needs, our comfort needs, and even have enough for some luxuries. But the trick is, one of the concepts in the book that we talk about is the fulfillment curve. We want people to have room for enough luxuries, but the fact is that after a certain point, and we identify that point as enough, we ask people, how much is enough? That's what's so unique about this book. We're not talking about amassing more, more, more money. We want people to identify what is enough, and we give them the steps in the program to be able to identify that for themselves.
Hmm. We were just talking a few minutes ago on the show about Vermont author Bill McKibben. His latest book, Deep Economy, talks about money in the same way, and how all over the world, happiness increases with income up to a fairly low number, like $10,000, and then after that, there's not a real high correlation between happiness and income. Did you find something similar in the research for this book?
Absolutely. It's exactly the same. I mean, Bill McKibben, I'm a huge fan of his, and I should say that I lived in Vermont, actually, in the late 90s, and I'm a big fan of your citizens. I think that they are self-reliant and smart and savvy, and a lot of them are
That's you, WDEV listener, she's talking to.
And yes, that's exactly right. I mean, it depends on who you're listening to in terms of economists. Some people will say the number is $20,000 in terms of how much money you need. But past that point, yes, we see that happiness does not increase with the more money you earn.
Okay, so let's say I buy that, and I want to take control of my finances. And I realize that, not every new dollar I earn is necessarily going to make me as happy as the first dollar I earned. What do I do then? What's the first step?
Well, one of the things we encourage people to do is just become conscious of how you spend your money. And the second thing is to make sure you get as much fulfillment as possible out of every penny you spend. And the trick is, once you make those two mental adjustments, you don't have to budget or restrict your spending necessarily in ways that take all the joys out of buying. Instead, by becoming conscious, then you're able to adjust automatically by yourself, voluntarily. You adjust this spending in ways that bring long-term prosperity. And I should add that most practitioners, within 6 months of doing this program, see their expenses decline by 25%.
25% within 6 months of starting this program.
Yes.
Hmm.
And as you mentioned, you know, the book was released in 1992, 17 years ago. But before that, before it even became a New York Times bestseller, before Vicki Robin was on Oprah twice, the original author and Vicki, so Joe Dominguez and Vicki Robin, were doing this program for years beforehand. So we have about 1 million people we know have done this program. We know that it works. And so that's why we can make these kind of statements.
Well, let's go through the history of the book in some detail. You mentioned that before the book came out in 1992, the two authors of that edition, Vicki Robin and Joe Dominguez, were promoting it. They had a series of cassettes and other things to promote it, right?
That's exactly right. And even before the cassette course, they were doing tours around the country. Joe was, he retired as a Wall Street analyst at the age of 31 in 1969. You know, he could have pursued a life of complete wealth and prosperity, but he kind of saw how the system truly worked. And it took him years to come up with this program, this 9 steps. But he taught himself over time, and he came up with these really what I consider to be brilliant insights into how people can get off this more is better treadmill and create, again, this life of, you know, what we talk about is having a life you love on the money you have.
It reminds me of a profile that I read of a dot-com billionaire. I forget his name exactly, which electronics industry that he was in, but he was pretty high-flying, and he kept adjusting his ambitions for his wealth as his wealth went up. It seemed like dollars that he owned were more than like points, showing how good he was relative to his competitors and anything else. And for a while, he was going to be satisfied with being a billionaire, and then having $10 billion was going to be good enough for him. And then he said, well, once he got over $10 billion, you know, it would be nice just for a while to be the richest man in the world. And he kept working. He didn't retire at 31 the way that Joe Dominguez did.
Right. I appreciate you bringing up that example, Carl, because we all know in this hyper-consumerist, materialistic culture in the United States, that is the path that most people choose. I mean, let's admit there is security in money, all right? But this trick, again, is finding out how much is enough for you, how much do you need. And security isn't only in money, though. Security is also in community and in having your own set of skills and not having to spend money on everything. And what you were kind of referring to is basically, you know, that most Americans have internalized that money equals fulfillment. And so when we talked earlier about this fulfillment curve, that you have enough money for luxury, for your comforts, for your survival needs, and for enough luxuries, what starts to happen is that fulfillment curve starts to level out. And we no longer are aware that we are spending money and having what we call a very low joy-to-stuff ratio. And so what ends up happening is that many Americans, as they get older, they have more responsibilities. They start to spend money in ways that they're spending so much more money and getting very little fulfillment. You end up in a house, a big house with a hot tub in the back and expensive exercise equipment in the basement. And you say, my gosh, I'm not fulfilled. I'm not happy. What did I do? Where did I go wrong?
We're talking with Monique Tilford. She's a co-author of the revised edition of Your Money or Your Life. And Monique, before we go to Jane Dwinell here in the studio, you're not one of the authors of the 1992 edition. Can you explain your role in the production of this new revised 2008 edition?
Sure. That is exactly right. I make that point all the time. I'm not one of the original authors, so that's why I can be more of a cheerleader for the book. But I did become familiar with the book right when it was released. I got to know the authors very well, started spending a lot of time with them. And so for the past 17 years, I've been an advocate for this book. I've been doing public speaking and leading study guide groups and was a board member for the organization. And then my role in this update was simply to update the statistics and the stories, to bring the investment chapter up to date, things like that.
Yeah, but you haven't retired yet.
Well, I practice the FI program differently, and everyone does this differently. Some people, like Jane, have been able to completely live off their interest income and have no plans to work for money again. The way I've done it, I have 2 young children. My husband works for a nonprofit 4 days a week, and I don't work for money at all. And so, but we've amassed a nest egg. If we wanted, we'd become completely FI, but we're living now in an urban environment. We choose to continue this life, but we're working very little for money.
And if enough copies of this book sell, you get some royalties, maybe.
Yes, we do.
All right. 244-1777 is a studio number here. 877-291-8255 is a toll-free number. We're going to go to Jane Dwinell, lives in Montpelier, is sitting here in our studio with us, the tail end of a long trip back to Montpelier. Jane, welcome here.
Thanks.
So tell us about your experience with your money or your life.
I first read the book in 1993. It immediately made sense, and my family and I started implementing the program. What makes us different than a lot of other people who read the book in that era is that we weren't people with big fancy jobs making a lot of money. We were homesteaders in the Northeast Kingdom making $7,000 a year. When I read Your Money or Your Life, and I looked to answer that question, what is enough? I knew $7,000 a year was not enough. We had 2 small children. It felt like we were living pretty much hand-to-mouth, even though we were growing our own food. If something happened to the car, we needed to repair it. It was always tense, and so I knew for us enough was more than that, but I didn't yet know how much it was.
Okay, so we've just heard from Monique that a lot of the people who start this program within 6 months have cut their expenses by 25%. Sounds like you went in the other direction. Did you increase your expenses and your income after reading this?
Well, eventually we increased our expenses, but initially we increased our income because we were already pretty frugal people as it was, but I wanted to have a little more. I also wanted to be able to provide for more for my children. I wanted to be able to travel with them and, we didn't want to buy them a lot of stuff, but if they, needed a new sled, I wanted to be able to buy it.
Well, that sounds modest enough. And you were living in the Northeast Kingdom. Were you tracking every dime then after you
read
this? Yes,
I have tracked every dime since 1993, and I still do it, and I couldn't imagine life without doing it.
That's part of the program.
It's part of the program.
Where does every dime go?
Where does every dime go? And one of the challenges for my family, as many people who do try to do this program, my husband was not that interested in tracking every dime. He's just not he's a frugal person, but he didn't like the idea of pieces of paper and writing things down. But over the years, we've worked out a system, and he just hands me receipts when he buys something, and then I do the keeping track.
And what did you discover in your spending when you started keeping track of every dime?
Well, one thing I discovered, even though we had as little money as we did at the time, my Gazingus pin, as they talk about in the book, of what the thing is that you tend to buy, was books. I loved books. I loved to touch them and shelve them and look at them, and I found I wasn't reading them. So I immediately stopped buying books and started using the library.
Okay, and eventually you moved out of the Northeast Kingdom. You're living in Montpelier now.
Yes.
What were the factors that led to that decision?
That was rather lifestyle kind of things. Our kids were then teenagers, and we didn't want to be driving the car all the time. It was time to see more of the world for them. Also, my mother, who was getting older, lives in Montpelier, and we thought we should be closer to her. It was just time for something different. My husband had lived in the Northeast Kingdom since the early 70s, and I since the early 80s, and we were ready for the big city.
And when Monique said that you were not interested in earning more money in the marketplace from here on out, is that accurate?
I don't know.
Okay.
I look at the job ads in 7 days every week just in case something tickles my fancy. But really, no, we don't. My husband's very clear. He has no interest in working anymore. And I might or might not, but right now I'm not interested.
And how old were you when you retired in this way?
Early 50s, 53, I think, 52, 53.
A lot earlier than most people. You aren't collecting Social Security yet.
No.
Okay.
I wonder if I will.
And you continue to live a homesteading lifestyle in Montpelier.
In Montpelier. We're urban homesteaders in Montpelier, still growing most of our food and heating with wood and living as simply as we did in the Northeast Kingdom, except we don't have to drive everywhere.
And what wonderful collection of raised beds in your yard.
We do.
And chickens, is that
and
right?
Chickens,
right.
Yes.
Okay. Monique Tilford, co-author of the revised edition of Your Money or Your Life. Is this a typical story you hear from people who read this book?
Yes, it is, actually. I really respect the choices that Jane and her family have made. I can add to that I know personally of a gentleman who, when he started this program 15 years ago, he was a $150,000 in debt. And then 9 years later, he and his wife, they had no children. They were able to stop working for money. And a year and a half ago, they bought their dream place up in Michigan. I know also of chambermaids in Pacific Northwest who have done this, so people who are really earning very little money. I met one 17 years ago who was completely financially independent at the time I met her. Really, it speaks to people of all different income levels.
How does the current economic situation affect the program in Your Money or Your Life? I mean, part of it is looking at the spending side of things, trying to get the most fulfillment out of what you spend your money on, but part is managing your financial assets wisely, and it seems hard to find ways to invest your money in such a way that it doesn't lose value these days.
It's true. So basically, the economy right now is in flux. No one knows where it's going to settle. So it's important that people preserve their capital. So we're recommending, you know, there are a lot of, we have an investment chapter, Chapter 9, people can look at. We encourage people to invest in CDs or treasury bonds. And it's a treasury bond. Some of them are paying very low right now. But at least you won't lose your capital. Whereas if you invest in the stock market at this time, there's still quite a risk that that will happen. We also encourage people to, of course, save money so they at least have 6 months and ideally even more expenses of ready money. And then to also take this time, actually, to acknowledge that durable goods now are quite affordable. So if you have the means to make a very conscious choice to maybe buy that car at this time because you get 0% financing, et cetera, but be very savvy about if you do it, and don't buy it with your credit card. You know, buy it with cash if you have it. And, of course, right now, most importantly, be sure to get out of debt.
Buy it with cash or keep your cash earning a little bit of interest for you and buy it with 0% financing?
Yeah, exactly. I've done that one time. I did that because normally I buy cash with everything. And one time I said, you know, I'm just going to do this on the 0% financing. So this is, again, this is a core part of the book. I mean, we talk about it's an FI program, becoming financial intelligent, having financial integrity, and eventually becoming financially independent. And this is the financially intelligent part where you look at the money, you do the math, and you come up with decisions that are going to lead to long-term prosperity.
Tell us a story about Russian bonds. It's at the beginning of Chapter 9.
Yeah, the Russian bond story. Vicki added that in to this re-release because Joe had experience with when he bought bonds, he wanted people, let me start again. Basically, with the Russian bond story, when people became FI, they became financially independent. He always gave them a Russian bond because he wanted them to remember that nothing is ever totally safe and secure. Because people get to this FI point and they think, oh my goodness, you know, I've made it. I'm never going to have to work for money again. And for most people, that's true. But, you know, you do have situations where the economy will tank, like happened in Russia, where these bonds became worthless.
Or in this case, it was because a new government came in 1917. These were 1917 right. Russian bonds that were probably pretty valuable at the time. But
they were valuable. And, you know, the amounts are still written on there. But, you know, at the time when Joe bought these, they were worth a penny each, and people were using them for wallpaper.
So this new paperback edition of Your Money or Your Life, how was it revised from the 92 edition?
One of the biggest changes to the book, of course, was updating the stats and the stories, because those things were all from the 80s, and we didn't want people to just pick up the old book and immediately discard it because they said it wouldn't speak to them at all. We also updated Chapter 9, which is the investment chapter, where we make very specific suggestions on how people can protect their capital and have it grow for them. We also wanted to update things because when the book was first written, the internet did not exist, and the whole concept of green consuming also didn't exist. So we updated those things and then also made refinements in other parts of the book.
So the chapter 6 on how to, seeing progress, the American
right.
dream on a shoestring,
that's
valuing
right.
your life energy, minimizing spending.
Yeah.
That was substantially updated just because there are so many other opportunities these days to find a bargain.
That's correct. And that's where we want to draw people to the internet because there's so many tips there, and it didn't make sense to take copy in the book to do that.
Do you have many people who are in a position that Jane is maybe in, where you want to live frugally, you also want to support the local economy, and you know, sometimes those draw you in different directions?
Thank you so much for bringing up that issue. This is one of the other parts of the book that I love so much, is because one of the core parts of the book is step 4. Where they ask people to ask a few questions about their spending. And one of the second questions is this expenditure of money in alignment with my values? So you get clear about what your values are. I, for example, have worked professionally for 20 years as an environmentalist, right? So within that context, buying local makes a lot of sense for me. So I have often made choices that weren't the cheapest choice. For example, my husband and I live a carbon-neutral lifestyle. We have 100% wind energy in our home. We buy carbon offsets for our car, and we use a debit card that pays for carbon offsets for everything we purchase. And the same thing goes with buying local. Sometimes you can get it cheaper on Amazon, but it's not supporting your values.
Jane, what are your comments on that?
We virtually buy everything local, even if it costs a little bit more. And we can do that partly because we hardly buy anything at all. I mean, that's the best way to save money, is to not spend it. And my favorite way is to, when I think of something that I want, I think, is there a way to get it without spending any money or very, very little? So, for example, we volunteer for many community organizations. If we want to go to a concert or a play or other event without paying for the tickets, we shop exclusively at thrift shops for clothing or rummage sales, and we just don't spend money. So this big economic crash hasn't affected our family at all.
And a lot of times when you buy things locally, you can buy it at the same price or a lower price than the big box stores or online.
Right. I'd rather walk downtown to Capital Stationers than drive up to Staples.
Do you ask for discounts when you go into stores?
It depends on the store and my relationship with that store. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't.
That's one of the things that may take many readers of this book by surprise, Monique, that you suggest that people haggle for things.
Yes, and I've done this for many years. It depends on where you are. One of the things we made sure to include is that that works usually at more locally owned stores. National chains don't have that same ability, but I have done that successfully.
Well, we're about running out of time here. Monique Tilford, co-author of the new edition of Your Money or Your Life, available in paperback at locally owned independent bookstores all over Vermont. You have any final comments for us?
It's funny that you bring up, because that's one of the final comments I wanted to make, is please buy the book locally.
Okay. Anything else?
No, I just really hope people will take a look at this book and have it give them the opportunity to have a life they love and the money they have.
Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jane Dwinell, one of the practitioners of Your Money or Your Life, living in Montpelier, blogging at vermontcommons.org. Any final comments?
I feel like this program has changed my life and allowed me to do things I never dreamed possible, and I'm more than happy to mentor any local people who are interested in taking up the program, and they can reach me through my blog at the Vermont Commons website.
And just to be clear, by this program you mean Your Money or Your Life?
Absolutely.
And not Equal Time on WDEV.
And not your program, Carl, no.
Okay, thanks so much for joining us, Jane Dwinell. Well, with oil at $35 a barrel, it's easy to forget, but the era of cheap oil is rapidly running out, and whether we like it or not, our economy is changing, and it's going to be changing in big ways. So as it does, you know, it's important to be positioned to take your economic fate into your own hands, not to be a victim of the larger, bigger economy. And a big part of that is understanding what money is, why it's important to you. Your money or your life, it's a good guide. I'm Carl Ettinger. That's it for today's Equal Time. Travin will be back tomorrow. Anthony, I believe, is that true, Jack? Yeah, okay. Not quite sure with the inaugural events, but Travin will be in tomorrow. Anthony Polina will host Wednesday and Thursday. I'll be back next Monday with Bill McKibben and Scott Horton. Scott Horton has written an article on justice after the Bush administration, on prosecuting members of the Bush administration for war crimes. Don't forget to check out EqualTimeRadio.com for podcasts of the shows that Travin and I host. And you know, maybe Anthony will start posting his shows there, too, with two of the three hosts posting there. Maybe we can get the third on board, too. Jack Donovan and Artie have been doing the engineering today. And after the 2 o'clock news, Jack Donovan will be on with good music until 5 p.m. Thanks for tuning in.